Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the 5 Minute Major podcast of St. Louis. We are pleased to be welcome with former Blue Reed Lowe, and he is one of the up-and-coming legends of St. Louis, as we like to say, with his new business of auctioneering that he'll be telling us about, and of course, his 256 NHL games. He had 19 total points, but he racked up some penalty minutes, and I'm sure he'll tell us some good stories. Reed, how are you doing? We're so happy to have you, dude.
Yeah, man, it's good. I'm doing real well. Sorry I missed you last week, but you guys were cool and decided to still have me on. So we made it happen, and here I am, and just looking forward to telling some stories and hopefully entertaining your friends and fans.
Yeah, no, we can't thank you enough, and I think this year we basically made it a goal was to try to get Blues alumni on, and like we can talk hockey, but it's nice to just talk to someone that played the game and was in the league for some years and put a punishing on a lot of guys throughout the years. But I mean, we're happy to have you, and let's hit the ground rolling. So you're a Manitoba Moose Jaw native there, I see. So
Saskatchewan.
Saskatchewan. Okay.
Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan. Manitoba's like it's our twin brother on the other side,
brother
east. But yeah, Moose Jaw's in southern Saskatchewan. And I always have to tell this because Jim Campbell Soupy would every time I'm like, I'm from Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, he always yells out, "Where's Moose Jaw?" And I'm like 6 feet from Moose's ass. So there you go, Soup. A little shout out to you, buddy. But yeah, it's a small town, wheat fields as far as the eye can see. You know, they always talk about Saskatchewan, watch your dog run away for 3 days. But there was a time in the early 90s where I think like the percentage was like 12 or 13% of the NHL was from Saskatchewan. And it's just a ton of small towns, and it's freezing cold, and that's all people do is play hockey. And you know, there's you throw the farm boy in there, and the next thing you know, you got some shit kickers, and away we go. And you throw some shit kickers and some hockey players, and you make them together. And those are some guys you want on your hockey team.
Yeah, no, yeah. That's I split time between like St. Louis, where I'm traveling, and then we have a house in Belleville, Ontario. Which there's not much going on in Belleville, but I'm like 3 minutes from the ice rink, so I love it when I get to go up there.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Belleville, Ontario.
You can blink and really miss it, but it's been good.
It's good.
All right. So you were drafted back in 96. Did you have like any thoughts that you're going to St. Louis to play?
You know, I grew up a tier two hockey player. I was never on the highest level team. I was always a guy that got cut, but I look back on it and think it was probably the best thing for me. I was a late bloomer. I got an opportunity to play more rather than being the bottom end of the top team. Yeah. I was at the top end of the second best team. And then like I always had a strong belief, and I know Brian Elliott shares the same thought process. We've talked about it from a young age. I just had this part of me that was like, I'm going to the NHL and I'll do whatever it takes. Right. And so I'm 17 years old and I go to Minot, North Dakota, and coach puts, I make the inter squad game, and I brought a duffel bag for the weekend. Like I wasn't expecting anything. And he put the two toughest guys in the team beside on the other team in the inter squad game, fought both of them, beat the brakes off of one guy pretty good. The other guy had a great fight. And scored 4 goals in the inter squad game. And the coach is like, hey, like, you think you can do that again? I said, score 4 goals in one game? He's like, no, beat the shit out of somebody. I said, well, does it mean I'm going to make the team? He's like, absolutely. I said, coach, literally, you point them out, I'll take them out. And that was my first step towards, hey, I now have a role that not only most guys don't want to play, but I'm actually kind of good at it. So let's go. And I've never been in a street fight or bar fight in my life. And, you know, I always tell people I wanted to fight more than I didn't want to make the NHL. And so it was just kind of that next step of, I don't care what I have to do. I'm making the next level. And then I played tier one hockey in the Western Hockey League in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, my hometown, with the Moose Jaw Warriors. I got drafted by the St. Louis Blues out of there. And then a year later, I signed an NHL contract and I'm on my way to start working my way through the minors. So when I got drafted, I wasn't like, I made it. You know, I got drafted and I was like, okay, now the work's begun. And that's really how you have to look at it. And so, yeah, I think it's just a, you know, it just was always going to happen. Like, I just didn't really have a thought process that was going to happen because I was willing to play any role. Am I going to be a goal scorer? You know, like, hell, I'd play goalie if I had to. You know what I mean? Like, I, you know, try and be as great a teammate as you possibly can, be coachable and work hard. And so I had a great hockey dad that helped me along the way. But, you know, there was always a strong belief inside me when everybody else was laughing that I was going to do it. And I wasn't over, like, I probably was a little more boisterous about it than I should have been. But at the end of the day, you know, I backed it up. So,
yeah. And that's what counts, right? I mean, you did what you had to do to do what you love. And that's such a, you're like the perfect role model for somebody trying to make it into the league. You know, it's the mentality aspect of it.
Yeah. I talked to a lot of the hockey clubs in St. Louis too.
And, oh yeah.
And, you know, I tell the parents, first off, this isn't a lottery ticket.
Right.
Yeah.
Plug it in. You know, these aren't lottery tickets. They're children, number one. And then kind of number two is like, it doesn't matter so much as to where you play. And I think that it's really one of the mistakes that, I see in, you know, hockey today, especially, you know, youth athletics, they push AAA. There's two AAA teams in St. Louis. Absolutely no need for two AAA teams. And there'd be 30 guys that are running those two leagues that'll tell me that I'm stupid. But really, you know, we're just diluting our talent all the way down doing it, right?
Yep.
I believe that the Junior Blues, which is not the AAA Blues, should have a place in St. Louis hockey. And right now we've got too many segregations instead of everybody coming together and saying, what's the best league? There's kids that are playing on 18U that should be playing tier three junior, but because the AAAs are more worried about, you know, having a team that's nationally ranked, they tell them that this is the best place for them. And so I just have a different thought process when it comes to the true development of players, and developing hockey players is my passion. When I do private lessons and help kids on the ice, no offense, like the top level kids, they typically have parents that have some money or whatever, but like, I want to go develop that kid that was me. I want to go develop that kid and give that kid a belief that, hey, nobody believed in you. You weren't good enough, but you found a way to make it happen. And you can't teach size. You can't teach work ethic. You can't teach coachability. You can't teach being a good teammate. And so if you have somebody that's willing to put it all on the line, you can help those guys accomplish, you know, different things in life. And maybe it's just the confidence in other areas of their life that's going to help them out. So,
yeah, I think that's the biggest thing with like modern day youth sports is that everyone's like, how much money can we throw at it? But then we forget the aspect. They're still kids. And then second off, some kids are just special. Some have that God-given athletic talent, but some, if you just have that work ethic, it will get you so much farther in life. And I think that's why I think a lot of fans in St. Louis love you, because you were a work boot mentality guy. And I think that's why a lot of fans like nowadays can relate to a Nathan Walker, because it's a work boot mentality kind of player that you bring your lunch pail to work every day. And it's like, I don't care what I got to do, but I'm that guy's 6'6". I'm still going to fight him, or I'm going to stand up for my teammate.
And I grew up loving Steve Yzerman. He was my guy, but I don't really have like a lot of favorite hockey players. Yeah. I'm a hockey fan, but I'm not a fanatic. But I'll tell you what, man, I love watching Nathan Walker play hockey. I love he's a great kid. He loves the city. He's spreading love down under right now with hockey camps and spreading some stuff out. And he's spreading the good word in the game. And he just works so hard. And again, he's another kid that most people be like, well, how's this kid make the NHL? He makes the NHL. Yeah, is he a good hockey player? Anybody that gets to the National Hockey League is a good hockey player. And when I was just got out of hockey and I was beer league and I was better than any one of those guys. And that's the funniest thing when tough guys go to the beer leagues. They're like, well, you were a tough guy. I'm like, no. I was a tough guy in the best league in the world, you dumbass. I still had to practice with these guys. I still had to get better at my skill. I still had to not be a liability on the ice. I'm not a shit bum. And same thing with Nathan. Like, I think that he has really cemented himself as an NHL hockey player. So even if the Blues think, hey, listen, he's expendable, whatever, there's another team that's going to grab a hold of that kid, yeah, because he is relentless on the puck. He stops and starts. He's a great teammate. Put him on the third line. Put him on the fourth line. He'll fight if he has to. Those are the kind of kids that I cheer for, man. And yeah, he's a heck of a kid and a heck of a talent. And, you know, being skilled like Connor McDavid's one thing, but when you look at kids that are his size and, you know, work as hard and do as many little things right as he does, you got to give him some credit.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Nathan Walker's just one of those guys that we'll always remember as Blues fans. And that's kind of where you come into play, just your toughness. What does it mean to you to be remembered as one of those toughest guys to ever wear the blue note and possibly in the league?
You know, I think it's funny because I don't really look at myself sometimes the way that others. I've got lots of confidence, yeah, and all that kind of stuff, but sometimes I don't really remember, you know, what I really did. And, you know, something as simple as I seen hockeyfights.com put something out the other day that's who are the top three fighting majors in St. Louis Blues history. And I was third on the list, and I was like, dang. I didn't know that, you know, like that's pretty cool. Like Brian Sutter, Kelly Chase, Reed Lowe, like, you know, I think I had 78 fights. I think Chaser had like 120 some. Yeah. And then Brian Sutter's like 167. Now, both those guys played double and quadruple the amount of games I did. So my fights per game were better, but, it's still crazy to think back and pinch myself. You know, as far as the blue note itself goes, man, it's such a storied franchise, and St. Louis has done such a great job in luring their alumni to stick around and be a part of the community. Yeah. And I think if there's anything I do, I take it from that. When I talk about it, I always have to give credit to Bobby Plager, the godfather, the OG. You know, this guy was everything St. Louis Blue. I think he worked for the team in total like 54, 55 years. That's incredible for somebody to have a career and to fill so many roles and to just epitomize what being a great teammate was all about. That's Bobby Plager. And, you know, he was interim coach and assistant coaches and probably negotiated some contracts along the way and was in ticket sales. And then at the end, he was just special assignments. Like, Bobby, we just going to pay it to be alive. We love just having you around, right? You're getting older. Like, you've always got a home here. And he just cemented himself, you know, with the team. And I think that, you know, when you take a look at what, you know, Bobby Plager taught us as guys, and he was always in the dressing room every single day. He was always around us. And he taught us how to play for the name on the front, not the name on the back. And I think that that's the one thing that I'll take away from it. There's 40 plus guys that are NHL hockey players, St. Louis Blues players that have retired here. I think even more credit. I don't love what the NHL's done. I think there's a disconnect between the players today, comparatively speaking, to 25 years ago, because they've limited the amount of appearances that have to happen. Yep. But hopefully with Barrett Jackman now taking over the Blues alumni and Alex Steen taking over the Blues, between the two of those guys, they can start to have some conversations with the players and say, I know you don't have to do this, but this is a little bit of a different town. I know there's at least a handful of guys that are talking about, like, current players within the last 5 years that have retired from hockey that are talking about moving back to St. Louis.
Yeah.
And Paul Stastny just moved back here, even though his dad and his mom live here. And his dad lives in Slovakia half the year anyways. But, you know, when you take a look at the guys that are coming back, it's pretty cool. It's fun to be a part of. And then couple that in with Monty being back and him, like, we consider, like, he's one of us. Like, he played for the Blues and in 94, whatever it was, in 95, and his wife's from here. And, like, it's like we got one of our Blues alumni that's coaching the friggin' team. Like, we're ecstatic about it. So it's a great town. We stay here for one reason. It's because it's the best damn sports town in the world. And I don't think it doesn't matter, you know, whether somebody believes it or not. But when, like, you look at all the baseball players, even the football players that still live here, like, St. Louis is an amazing community. They get a little bit of crap for how crazy downtown is in the east side with murders and crime. That's not what St. Louis is. No. St. Louis is a wonderful town with a lot of people that got a lot of love.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And we talked pre-show. Like my dad's been on the city fire department for 30 plus years. My uncle was on the city fire department. My dad's dad, my grandpa was on the city fire department. And like St. Louis for us is something special. And I think a lot of players from the outside perspective might not understand that until they come here. And then they get a little taste of it. And you see, like, there's a reason this many alum come back. It's not this ruse that it's not a good place to live. You can raise a family. You can live comfortably here. You can hang out with your best friends that you met here your whole life. And
I've been retired for 18 years. I still get paid to go sign autographs. And people actually show up. I'm like, oh my God, there was a fan out there. I love it. You know, it's crazy.
That's the best part about this place. And I think through the ups and downs of the Blues throughout the years, like, our fan base loves this team. And, you know, every city can say you have a diehard fan base, but this city bleeds blue. And it's wild to watch over the years. And I mean, I grew up watching hockey my whole life. My dad was watching hockey, and, you know, you can't but get excited. We're ready for hockey to get going. Like,
dude,
this
off season has been
brutal, just waiting for hockey to be back.
Boring.
It's like,
boring
off
season.
Like,
fall is my favorite time of the year. Baseball's going in the playoffs. Yep. So we can actually start to pay attention because nobody gives a shit until September.
Exactly.
You can lose every single game in May and still win the pennant. That's not necessary for me. But baseball's going to the playoffs. Football's getting started up. There's nothing better than me and my kids smoking food, drinking some drinks, and hanging out. Watching NFL on Monday, or sorry, on Sundays. Well, Monday nights too.
Yeah, Monday.
And all day Sunday. But I think St. Louis is special because the Rams won a trophy. The Cardinals have won trophies. But I told everybody Market Street will never be the same when St. Louis Blues win a Stanley Cup, and it wasn't.
No,
and
it was not.
I know that, like, they had the blimps and just kind of getting a head count on what's there, and they said, like, about 750,000 people. Like, that's a third of the greater city.
Yeah.
And we're on the float, and they've got us on these steak trucks, and it's basically like a flatbed, and then there's these steaks they put along there, and they've got coolers with champagne and beer, and like, the street couldn't be any more packed. Phone booths, or not phone booths, and nobody knows what a phone booth is anyways. bus stops, people are sitting on top of them. All the parking garages, there's people hanging out on top everywhere. We turned, and how it came down, we like turned on Broadway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It goes south, but Broadway was shut down. And I looked north, and it was wall street to street, packed all the way to the Jones Dome.
Yeah.
It was insanity. I thought Mardi Gras was crazy when our Blues alumni have a float there, and you look up Lafayette or one of those streets where you look up to the highway, and they're just jam packed. Broadway was jam packed for 15 blocks. It was the most insane thing I've ever seen. We drank St. Louis out of beer. That's what I'm talking about.
Yes.
That's why St. Louis is the best, right? Well, you know, when the St. Louis Blues win the Stanley Cup, there are going to be no more Bud Light. There's going to be no more Budweiser. There's no more Select. It was the greatest thing ever, and I'll never forget it. The players were 3.5 hours delayed for the TV programming. They were getting off their floats. They were letting people drink out of the Stanley Cup. Like,
that's so much fun.
It's just a different place to be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was one of the most memorable. I remember getting down there, and we got there super early because I was like, I got to be there to see this. And it was one of the most memorable moments in my life, because it's like, my dad, he was like, man, I waited my whole life to see us win a cup. And he goes, you don't know how lucky you are, first off. But he goes, this is it, one of the most emotional filled just moments in his life, too, where you're just sitting there, you're like, holy shit, we did it.
Yeah.
And that kind of is one of those things where, talking about memorable moments and that, like, what was your all-time most memorable fight you had wearing the blue note? If you had to pick one, which I know it's hard, which one are you going with?
You know, I think like I go to the same one. This is such an impossible question because I have the second most penalty minutes in NHL history in a single game. I got in a fight the night that I scored my first NHL goal against Patrick Waugh on my dad's birthday.
Nice.
The games, you know, so that's got to be a memory that's up there. You know, and even though there's a dual memory inside of that one, but, you know, honestly, probably because like my fight with PJ Stock is one of the most watched fights on YouTube. And it's without question the most viewed fight that I have. And it's right up there and it gets ranked in the top 100 fights of all time, typically somewhere between 35 and 50. I don't really get into rating those things, but I know that we had a bout and PJ and I, talk about it. And we have talked about it. We were actually just on Tyson Nash's podcast called the Nashcast. And actually they surprised me and brought PJ on. So we talked about it a little bit more. We hung out that night after and drank beers with Shiners and we just punched each other in the face. And like, there was 15 minutes left in the third period, Saturday afternoon in the Boston Gardens. And, you know, it's a 2-2 game. And I look at PJ and he's on the ice. I'm like, bro, we're not getting another shift. Why don't we put a show on for the fans? And he's like, let's do it, buddy. And we just dropped the gloves and we went after it. And people watched that fight. And there's the announcers, which were the worst homers in the history of hockey. And they're like, and they hitch up, and I start throwing rights, and right off the bat, PJ just twists himself around and just starts chucking lefts right back at me. And then the camera pans over here, and it's just like, I'm hammering, and he's hammering, and we're just like, got our heads kind of half cocked like that, just absolutely getting after it. Then we rest around, switch up. I hit him with a couple uppercuts. He hit me with a few good ones. And, you know, just like me and PJ always had, like, pound for pound, like, between him, Ryan Vandenbush and, you know, Ty Domi, you know, the toughest guys pound for pound that I ever played against. Like, for those guys to be 5'10 and fighting guys that are 6'4 and having some level of success or being just stupid enough to do it again, I don't know how you want to put that into perspective. But at the end of the day, I think that that's probably the fight that I would have to pick.
Yeah. That's actually insane to think about. I mean, you mentioned Ty Domi. In one of those games where you had the most PIMs, it was against Calgary, I believe.
Yeah, 57, and then I had 53 against Detroit.
Okay, so against Calgary, was Berube like their toughest guy on that team?
Yeah, but
he wasn't chucking him that night.
He was kind of getting a little, like, I think he was getting a little older.
Yeah, okay.
I fought him in the first period, but hey, I don't think he really wanted to fight. Yeah. He's probably just like, another young buck chasing me around the ice. Like, I had that happen to me. So actually, Chief, I apologize for that. But you know what goes on. You know how that works. But I totally get it now.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, oh, that's how shitty that feels. Okay, yeah, thanks. I appreciate it. You know, I got to go say a few apologies to these guys after for chasing them around trying to get hungry. But my sixth fight ever in the history of the game in the NHL was against Bob Probert. And Probert, I had been in 5 fights in 5 games, and Bob Probert looked at me and he was like salivating. I'm like, aren't I the guy that was supposed to be coming after you? But he was this little kid. Like, you want, like, I love the tough guys. Bring it on. You think you're tough? Yeah, let's do this, you know? So I survived that fight too. So it was a win.
Did you, I think on that Detroit team, Avery was on that team too. Did you ever have any run-ins with him or no?
Sean Avery's gloves were glued on when it came to me. If Sean Avery would have dropped the gloves with me, it probably would have been the best Christmas present I ever received. he would have finished fourth in that fight.
He was just the mental toughness with him in the, in the games he played.
He's just a complete donkey.
Yeah. He's an interesting guy.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, man.
He's not an attention whore at all. And that's coming from an attention whore.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, that's saying something.
How do you think the change of, like, that enforcer mentality has affected the game today? Like, I feel like it's still necessary in ways, but I feel like we've strayed away from it. But I feel like sometimes you still need that guy that puts a little fear in the back of your mind when you're on the ice, don't you think?
You know, it's a topic that I get asked a lot about. I'm extremely passionate about it. Yep. And I tell you, the number one reason why I don't like it is because, well, before I get to that, let me talk about why we are here. So in the mid 90s, after the strike, I think it was a strike in 94, 95, something like that, they changed the instigator rule to where before, if you did something stupid, the refs and the teams all policed the game themselves. Yep. I would go out, I would grab you, whether you turtled, ran, crawled over the boards, it doesn't matter. You're going to get a 5-minute major. I'm going to get a 5-minute major. And then I'm going to get a 2-minute minor penalty. My team's got to kill one off. And they're like, kill it off for Losey. He went out there and took care of things, right?
Yeah.
They changed the scope with the referees on that after. And there was a time when I could grab a guy, and if he turtled and didn't fight back, I could get a 5-minute major, a 2-minute major, and then a 10-minute misconduct. So not only am I out for 17 minutes of the game, but he didn't get a fighting major. So now I'm putting my team down by 7 full penalty minutes and a 5-minute major that you can score as many times as you want on.
Yeah.
This wasn't advantageous for me to do for my hockey team. So what it did was it diluted that part. And then the next thing that kind of happened was the coaches started saying, hey, listen, when we get up by 4 or 5 goals, don't fight. And it was almost a point where that would be a time where I would go out and have my fight and then whatever else. And if we were still getting our butts kicked, then I would get ice time. But I would almost not get any ice time because my coach knew, number one, that I didn't have the ability to say no in that instance. But he also knew that there was a potential of momentum swing. And regardless of their tough guy came out and I beat the brakes off him or not, his team was still going to get a level of spark.
Yep.
For me, it brought a hockey game that was not so great back to life, which is what we should want, right? Like, we signed the dotted line to go out there and fight for our teammates and fight for our team. And unfortunately, that constitutes, if we're getting our asses kicked 5-0, the tough guy's got to go out there, grab somebody, and try and change the momentum. Typically, you're going to change the entire momentum of the game. They're going to come back regardless a little bit, and you're going to have a good hockey game. But coaches wanted to see those blowouts. They didn't want close games. If they were up 5-0, tough guys sitting on the bench and that's it. So that was the second kind of part that I feel like, you know, happened. And it was kind of happening in my generation. And then you bring the 405 lockout, and they changed the rules on interference. And that really put a damper on the game because that big, tough defenseman or that burly right, left winger that would, you know, be physical, you know, that kind of, he lost some more opportunity there. In the last 10 years, they've taken it to a junior hockey level and they've limited the ability for guys to fight at that junior level. So when you take a look at what the NHL's done over a 30-year period, they've not eliminated the tough guy position, but they've really done a good job of making sure that those guys could play, which I don't have any problems for.
Yeah.
I just wish that they weren't killing it at the junior hockey level because that's where I got my opportunity. And there's not a lot of guys that are willing to step in and say, hey, listen, like, if this is the only way that I get to make the NHL, I'm still doing it. And I want to be a part of it and I don't care what it takes. And that kid's not going to get an opportunity to live the dreams that I did because the NHL's lost it a little bit. And then on top of all of that, Wayne Gretzky barely got body checked and Sidney Crosby spent 2 9-month stints on the IR from a concussion for being body checked.
Yeah.
So where is it right? Where is it wrong? You know, people look at me as some barbaric Sasquatch. But when they get to know me, they recognize that, man, this guy's a protector of his people. He's not a malicious fighter. And there was some malicious fighters out there. Like, you know, Tony Twist loves to fight. Like, he just loves to fight. He'd beat your ass on the ice. He'd beat your ass in the bar. And he'd beat your ass in the jail cell after we were all done and said it was there. So, you know, but that's just Twister. And that's not me. I wanted to do the job because I wanted to protect my teammates. And that role is the only reason why I made the NHL. And so it makes me a little disheartened to know that there's a kid out there that's not going to get the opportunity that I did because they chose to shut down something that was probably more necessary than they gave thought when they did their, you know, made the decisions they have.
Yeah, I think
you're good, Mike.
I think the development too has just completely changed. Like these young kids are now, they're just speed, skill, you know, even if you're a bottom tier player, you know, you're playing fourth line minutes, you're still like skilled, you know, like a Toropchenko is a skilled player.
Yeah.
100%. And he can still lay the body. Right. And I think that's just a big part of it too. Like no one's,
well, hockey's growing.
Yeah. It's really everyone's doing more.
Like we're not just going out and having fun hockey camps. Like, parents are investing in these kids and giving them private lessons and sending them to, you know, like the hockey school here in St. Louis. What's HTP or
something? Yeah, the one out at Centennial that they have.
Yeah, Phil McRae runs it. Right. And I forget the name of it off the top of my head, but like they're paying $25,000 for their kid to go there a year and they're getting their schooling, they're getting everything done. And so there's a bigger investment because, you know, kids aren't just making like back in the early 90s, late 80s, making 75, 80 to $1 million a year, or a couple million bucks a year. Like the lowest paid player in the NHL is making 800 grand a year. That's good. You get 10 years at $800,000. That's,
you're doing pretty good at that point.
Unless you got a posse of about 30, you're going to have some money in the bank. You know?
Yeah.
I think that was always the thing, that hockey just was so expensive. And I mean, I was a South City kid. So like, My parents were like, hockey is not in the realm. But like, I mean, we played roller hockey growing up. We did all the things.
You can play soccer.
Yeah, that's,
hanging with all the grass fairies. I love soccer, and not especially since the city. But that's been my thing forever because we don't have grass for 4 or 5 months in Canada. So we don't get to play soccer.
Exactly.
Yeah, no. Well, that was the thing when we moved up to Canada and got our house all situated. I just walk around, you're like, hockey goal, hockey net, hockey net, hockey net. Everyone's got one. The whole back corner of our subdivision, they just make into an ice rink at part of the year. Yeah. So I'm like, I'm pumped for the winter because I'm like, I'm going to be out there playing hockey with these kids.
Yeah.
Probably getting schooled by a bunch of like 6 year olds, but hey, it's fine at this point.
Yeah, for sure.
But no, so life after hockey. I know we've talked about hockey. I know we talked that you're doing your business as well, but I liked how we kind of were leading up to this, that we all have a fight going on outside of hockey. And I kind of want to give you a moment to kind of talk about that as well, because I think that's a part of you that I think people should know, because it means a lot that, you know, we all have a battle going on. You talked about that. I don't know if you want to kind of talk about it a little bit. Sure.
I really feel like, as a young man, you know, I was asked to go out there and hurt other people. And not only was I praised for it and paid for it and celebrityed for it and everything else, and that can catch up with you. And then when you retire, for these guys, it's challenging to have where are you going? What are you doing? Where are we at? All that kind of stuff. And what's my identity today? And I think for me, it hit me a little bit later after life, where I went through a dark time in my life. I'm so thankful that I made it through. I found some spirituality, which was very important for me to have somewhere else to go that isn't human. And I think the biggest thing that I want to be able to give back to and open up is that there is a fight. And it doesn't matter whether you're an ex-NHL enforcer, an ex-minor league enforcer, or you work at McDonald's, or wherever you're at, everybody has a fight on the other side of it. And so I created about 2 years ago this thing called Friday Night Fights, and it was just like fight, fight, fight. So I was just breaking down fights. I ended up getting busy, and I kiboshed it. And then I had a couple guys step forward, Joe Farmer and Tommy Holmes. And they were like, hey, let's get this started up again, you know, and especially with Joe, he's a very creative guy. And we didn't even like do anything. The first 10 times we met, we didn't even film. We just talked. They'd come over and I said, like, if I'm going to do this again, I want to make sure that I do it right. And we get this thing right. And so I think we got it right. We've released some short videos here over the last month and a half. Some fun, cool content that's getting some real looks. And you can see them all on my YouTube channel, which is Read Low TV. And then you can go to my Instagram, which is Low Read 34, and just have some fun with it. Like, this is nothing but just really trying to have a good time. So we tease people with these, and then we just got done our first episode with Cam Jansen. And we talk about the fight. We talk about the best fights. We talk about a lot of the stuff you guys talk about. But I want to make sure that I talk about what the fight is in Cam's situation and my situation away from the ice. But it's not a celebrity thing either. It's you know, there's people that are in a fight that maybe aren't hockey players or whatever, but they're still hockey fans, and they're maybe not a celebrity to the world the way the celebrity sees, but I like their story and I want to bring them on, and I want them to break their story down, how they fell, how they grew, what they came. And I tell, you know, I tell people all the time, like, you know, we live in a world today that's just hates each other for the most part. It's unnecessary to be like that. But at the end of the day, we hate ourselves more than we hate those around us. And I've come to realize that the more that I could love myself unconditionally, the more that I could give somebody else that same unconditional love. Because if I can't have it for myself, how in the hell am I supposed to be able to have it for somebody else? Right.
That's so true.
And so I adapted a couple mindsets, and have taken, you know, some of these things on. First off, you need a place to pray. Like, it's so significant and it's so important. And for me, that's Jesus. You know, I started walking with him because he's kind. He's a healer. He gives more than he takes. He's unconditional. And he's, in my opinion, the only perfect person to walk the face of the earth. And he died for us. And so that was a good place for me to start. You know, the next step, once I kind of started to adapt to that and I started to have a Bible study and I started to find a place where I could go that wasn't human, I needed to take myself from human read and go somewhere, was gratitude. I practice gratitude every single day. Everything, something comes into my mind or in my heart that isn't right, I think of three things that I'm lucky and grateful to have in my life. And what I've realized over the last 2 years from that is I start to see things differently. I'm not looking for the bad things that are about to happen to me. Instead, I'm looking at all the beautiful things that are happening to me. And there's beautiful things that are happening to people that don't look at that. They're just not able to see it. And so how can I help people find that? How can I help people look for that? How can I help somebody that's struggling like I was to be better in their own spot? Not for anything else, not for anyone else, but themselves, because the second that they help themselves in that moment, they're going to be able to help so many other people around them. So, you know, I do that. And then I'm really fortunate enough to be a charity auctioneer. I did over 60 auctions last year. I get to work with every type of, whether it's a family that's going through a hard time, or it's Cardinal Glennon or Make-A-Wish, or, you know, all of the charities you can possibly imagine. I'm fortunate enough to be able to get up on stage and entertain people and have some fun. People always tell me that they spent more than they wanted. And I said, make sure you tell the people that planned this so they have me again next year. But I just decided that I was going to live in a place that was happy. And I know this is hard for people that aren't happy to hear. And I was one of those people. So I'm very empathetic to it, but happiness is a choice. And you can choose it, and you can choose to put yourself in places that has happiness, not sadness. You can put yourself in a place where people are happy and to be around the people that are going to bring out the best in you. And so that's my goal. That's what I'm doing. And I love spreading love. I love loving people. I love giving people hugs, and I love just being a, hopefully being a bright light in a world that seems to be dark.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. And I think I wanted to give you this opportunity because I think, like you said, people have seen you as the fighter in the wearing the blue note, protecting his teammates. But there's so much more to all of us. And I really wanted to give you this opportunity, at least with us and for our fans and everyone that kind of watch our show, just like there's so much more out there in this world. And I don't think we talk about it enough. And I think through working in healthcare, you learn to appreciate what you have because you don't know how long you're going to have it.
Yeah.
And that's been, I never would have thought I would have realized that And, you know, you go into healthcare thinking you're going to save everything and you're going to fix it all. But like, it's a humbling world in a world where you really get recentered on a daily basis.
And you can see, for where you're talking to, like, you had an upfront first row seat to the worst tragedies and the greatest miracles maybe in the same day. Yeah. Like, you want to talk about an emotional roller coaster to ride, and then you got to come home and you're like, now what am I doing? Like, where am I at? Like, where is my own thing at? And so, like I said, that's why I always start. I'm like, prayer. I pray all the time. I love praying. I do it a lot, but I don't do it enough because I don't pray before I eat. And that's my one thing that is like, it's not a New Year's resolution, but it's something like, because it's a little awkward, you know, you're alone at the table, you're like, okay. And also, and I was telling my buddy on my Bible study this, and he's like, well, don't be selfish. Ask everybody if they want to pray. I was like, maybe I should do that, you know?
I feel like that was such a big part of my life growing up.
Yeah.
Praying at the dinner table. Like,
oh yeah, dude.
And that was like the main place we prayed. Like,
yeah.
But then it was like, if you wanted to pray in any other situation, it was like so private, and that it was the opposite feeling.
And that's the one thing, like, you know, for me, it's like, this doesn't have to be private. This should be something that we spread because it's peaceful and it's loving. And it's like, why wouldn't we pray? Right. And no matter how evil or how mad somebody is at you, if you face them with unconditional love, it's impossible to hate on somebody that is giving you nothing but love in return, because love wins every single time. But we as humans choose to not allow that to happen. So what happens if we were all to say, okay, I'm not going to be upset, I'm not going to be mad anymore, I'm just going to love the world, and I'm going to share, and I'm going to be great. Like, we would have no like, it would be crazy. Like, people would be, there'd be no homeless people. Yeah. We wouldn't have Fathom. We wouldn't have, you know, welfare. We wouldn't have problems because we were just taking care of each other. And it's an impossible thought process. It's an impossible look, but man, let's talk about it.
Yeah. I think as we get older and you look back, and like, I know when I was younger, and I mean, I spent plenty of time at Mike's house, and we did pray before meals because your mom made the best meatballs still to this day. Good
Lord.
Come on,
meatballs.
Yeah. Honestly, call over Mike's mom. The Italian heritage in that household, man, you will not go home hungry.
No.
But good Lord, it's one that, and we went to Catholic grade school. So like, you kind of get it slammed down your throat in a way, but then you leave, you go to college, you're like, man, all right, whatever. I don't care what I'm doing. And then you get to a point where you're like, wow, what they were actually talking about meant something.
Yeah.
So it's just wild.
I agree.
But Mikey, what you got?
I don't know if I have any other questions. I think this
is
the perfect place
to
end, honestly.
Yeah.
What do you think?
Yeah. No, I love
I don't
this.
Have any other like hockey questions or life questions. I think that was great and perfect.
Yeah.
And I think the fans and friends and family that are listening are going to love it.
Yeah.
Shout out your social media again, Reed, and we'll have it in the link. We'll have it linked below. And yeah, we appreciate it.
You can find me on Instagram at lowreed34. You can find me on Facebook. I've got a personal page. I also have reedlow34. And then my website's reed-low-34.com. And then, you know, if you need anything from, you know, somebody to entertain you, I do public speaking engagements, just talking about life and the transition of everything that's happened in my life, which is so ridiculous. Like, I did one a couple weeks ago, and the guy's like, man, you know, I wish we could have you back. I'm like, dude, you could have me back five times and I could tell you I could have five different things that I do. Like, it's endless. My mom and I were joking about 2 months ago. We're talking on the phone. I'm driving somewhere. And I was just telling her everything that's going on. And she's like, Mom, sometimes I feel like I'm riding on a roller coaster in life. And she's like, son, you're not riding on a roller coaster. You are the roller coaster. And I'm like, yeah, I'm the roller coaster. So I'm so humbled and grateful to be a part of this community. to have the opportunity to jump on with you guys and share some stories and be able to kind of tell my truth and, you know, give the real read and who I want to be and who I want to be a part of, who I want to be a part of and how we want to make this thing happen. So Friday Night Fights, check it out. Cam Jansen's going to be our first guest. We're going to have shorts a couple time a week, and then we're going to have a little bit of a longer session. And from there, we'll see what else happens. You know, I got if you need anybody to be an auctioneer or public speaker, you know, I'd be your guy. Just reach out to me on one of those spots and sit down, have a conversation, find out what your needs are and see if I can help. It's real simple. No pressure.
Yeah, we will make sure to put all that and definitely get your opportunities you have and what you can offer out there. And we cannot thank you enough. This has been great. I think for the coolest part for us is that it was more than hockey. And I think that's even better than anything.
Yeah. But there's real life out there. We're all hockey fans, but you know, I wake up every morning and thank the Lord that I got an extra breath in my lungs. We're not here long. So I'm just going to make sure I have the best time ever.
Love it. All right, folks, as always, Mikey, we finish with a, let's go Blues. All right, guys.
Let's go Blues. Thanks, guys. Can I just tell one story before
we go? Yeah, of course.
Do you guys remember the night I was at the game? I was in the Blues alumni box, and I think it was Angela Sharp was doing the when they had the stoppages in play, whatever you call that. Like, it's not an intermission. Like, it was the players were on the bench. Everybody was in their seats. They're answering the questions, and she's like, can I get a Let's Go Blues? And the guy goes, let's trade Brewer. And entire stadium absolutely went, yeah.
Oh,
and
my
I just looked at down at Brewer, and he just like put his head down. He's just like, oh, man. So that's my Let's Go Blues thing. And last thing before I go, stop this shit on the power play.
I hate you.
So bad.
I hate that.
Oh, that's the worst.
It's the worst. If we
what are we doing?
We're plugging it in, Aaron UE, baby.
It's terrible.
I seriously, it's against the law and you're not allowed to do it, but I want to smack somebody when they do that just so they know what the pain is I'm going through internally by watching them do this.
Oh man, that ain't the truth. Good Lord, that needs to stop.
You guys are the best. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Reed.
We appreciate you. Thanks, man. All right.
Cheers.